Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Jerome Stern Writers Series. We're about to get started.
And up first to introduce Josephine Yu is Tanya Gray.
Nope, can't do it without glasses, sorry. I met Josephine Yu on the page. As is often the case, we are first introduced to a poet and writer through their work, their voice speaking to our imagination, lighting rooms and rattling complacency from the nooks of our inner life. In 2013, a classmate from my MFA program was the first runner-up in the Plowshares Emerging Writers Contest, a contest in which Josephine was the winner for her poems, Never Trust a Poem That Begins with a Dream, and Narcissist Revises Title Theory. With indelible images, like currents spinning in a gyre that collects the flotsam of my affairs, plastic spoons and condoms, frozen dinner trays, snow globes, souvenirs, chewed pens, the woven mesh of lawn chairs, a cooler lid, nurdles of exfoliating soap, and sends it swirling in the Pacific to tangle in seaweed and clog the seagulls' throats. From that moment, I was hooked. I've seen her work again and again in magazines all over the country. The poet Kim Adonizio finds in Josephine's work a belief in transformation and in moments that can only be called grace. The upwelling tenderness for strangers, getting stoned behind the school library, embracing a lover from behind as he washes the dishes. For you, the God of despair is the father of the God of attention. Our own David Kirby says 100 voices bubble out of you's pages, each one beseeching you to listen. You'd be crazy not to. Josephine Yu is the author of Prayer Book of the Anxious, winner of the Judges Prize of Elixir Press Poetry Award for her debut collection. Her poems have appeared in journals such as Plowshares, Agni, The Southern Review, Tri-Quarterly, and Best New Poets. In addition to winning the Plowshares Emerging Writers Contest, she has been honored with Meridian's Editor Prize, the New Letters Poetry Award, and the New Letters Readers Award for Poetry. Josephine earned an MFA from Georgia State University and a PhD from Florida State. She's one of ours. So won't you please give your warmest welcome to Josephine Yu.
Thank you so much for that really generous introduction. I didn't even pay her. And I'm so happy to be here. And I just got this tarot card that says, don't be intimidated, which is very helpful because y'all look fierce. So I want to start with something light, a little love poem called How Do You Say? Reaching for the phone, I step on the dog's tail, and she nuzzles my ankle in apologetic reverence, her perpetual state. Another friend is calling for congratulations, another engagement. Everyone I know is thinking of falling in love or falling out of love, either way, with both feet on the edge, like the concrete lip of the deep end. And shimmering before them, the cold, drowning water of adoration, or the cold, drowning water of loneliness. And everyone is referring to the languages of love, though no one seems to have read the book, just flipped through the table of contents at Walmart. But it's enough to know not all of the languages of love are actual languages, not French, as you might expect, mon amour, or Italian, ti amo, vita mia, but the language of sweeping the garage without being asked, or necking at the movies, or scooping out the litter box. So the broom's metronome counts the beat of love, and tongues trace the calligraphy of love on the cartouche of collarbone. And for my friend with the pregnant wife, even the kitty litter spells out love with its alphabet of odors as he scoops clumps of piss, hissing over his shoulder at the cats who lattice the shower curtain and burrow in the mattress. Because for cats, the language of love and the language of possession are lyrics to the same aria, While dogs, those Mozarts, hum just one uncomplicated bar over and over, yet we hear the swelling of a symphony. I forgot to mention it's really a love poem to my dog. And here's another love poem for a new endangered species, middle class love song. When some know-it-all on public radio insists income is more hereditary than height or weight, and some other dour economist agrees we're on the fast track back to serfdom, we shrug, so yeah, maybe everybody's broke, but not too broke to catch a matinee at Miracle 8 or grab a venti from Starbucks. And okay, so our rental looks kind of trashy, the jasmine vine dying on the chain link in a gothic brown tangle. Poisoned, we think, by our duplex neighbor's latest crazy ex. But we're rich in monkey grass, which spreads so wildly that the neighbor's kid just mows it down in a verdant stubble. And we may not have tidy box hedges or a golf cart to tootle around the block in, like the doctor in the McMansion next door, his yellow labs loping in the wake of his cigar smoke. But we also don't have his patients suing us for urethral surgery mishaps. And we can hear the jazz from the Bose speakers of his gazebo on dusky Sunday evenings. And we dance on our front stoop, just hugging, really, a long swaying hug. And at least we have this cement stoop, right? And this fenced yard our dog patrols with full-hearted devotion, as if she's guarding the Taj Mahal. And Coltrane on a humid breeze, and our hug dances, and our glossy textbook of crazy exes, and the medieval tapestry of our jealousies, not to mention the pleasure of knowing our children and our children's children will have ever-increasing latte options, and even richer neighbors, and even crazier, more creative exes. Things to look forward to. You know, I try and be an ethical consumer, but sometimes I sneak into Walmart, which I think is the one thing I do that drives my husband crazy. He's probably sitting there thinking, oh yeah, the one thing. So this is another poem with Walmart, an increase in the cost of living. The ocean of my love for you is threatening to flood the B-list celebrities and low-carb diets of your California, and it's only going to get worse. The health department placed leghorn chickens across the county to track West Nile. Mosquitoes, preferring dark meat, nestle through feathers to suck the thighs. When you have been strategically placed for such a purpose, you are called a sentinel chicken. August Urson, government worker, swings each chicken by the legs before drawing blood. Stunned, the chickens submit. You never asked that much of me, but lover, I broke my promise not to shop at Walmart. Do you know how much produce costs these days? Are bananas 50 cents a pound? A dollar? How can we communicate when you always assume my questions are rhetorical? At Walmart, a man blocking the doors with a Budweiser truck was arguing with a cop. Cop insisting Shelley Winters had to be the worst actress who ever lived. Budweiser sputtering, have you seen Money Pit? I should have told Budweiser he was thinking of Shelley Long, but the cop was already writing him a ticket. Lover, whose good name will we defend, mistaken but intense, some humid night? The lab results are in. We're at risk for hypertension, kidney failure, anemia, and chronic disillusionment. Enjoy that banana, love. It's a Cavendish, the genetic twin of every other grocery store banana, perfect and seedless, but not as sweet as the last variety, those Big Mike bananas wiped out by Panama disease. You can stay the night, but you should know my grandma sends prayer cards, unsigned checks for 10 bucks, and once a fake penny the size of my palm. I put them under my pillow. A lot of good it will do, sure, but without that rustle of offerings, I would lie awake, stunned. Oh. Thank you. You know, I just really love going to the movies. I think there's nothing as luxurious as dozing off during Rogue One in the middle of a Wednesday afternoon. I think that must be how the 1% live. The only problem is, you know, all the other people at the theater. A vindictive son of a bitch of a poem. The woman sitting next to me in the theater drove me insane, texting on her cell phone with her acrylic nails. Click, 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 ski chase down Mount Everest. Click, 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 plot twist. Click, click, matching briefcase exchange. Click, 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 the double agent, click, click, takes a bullet for his brother, the submarine, click, click, operator. You've heard me complain about cell phones before, and you might think this time I saw the woman's face lit up in the blue glow and thought she looked like my sister, and then realized something about our common humanity. Well, don't get your hopes up. If you're expecting a moment of redemption or a metaphor or anything other than the sound of my house key squealing across the passenger door of her Jetta, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you've got the wrong poem. This poem curses her children. May her sons be born with extra nipples. It wishes her adult acne and a string of bad dates followed by a string of bad marriages. In fact, this poem is madder than I am. If it could, it would smite her with hair loss, eczema, tax audits, flat tires, high cortisol levels, irritable bosses, irritable bowel syndrome, halitosis, and irregular periods in white pants. You might be disappointed in it. Yeah, it's got a mean streak. It can be a real asshole. But you don't know its story. Maybe it grew up on the streets, eating wilted lettuce from the dumpster behind Albertsons. Maybe it was just passed up for a promotion, or its rent check bounced again, or its girlfriend left with the coffee maker and the CDs but didn't take that goddamn shih tzu that pisses in the closet. Or maybe its father just died and it realized it will never be half the poem he was. So that was a poem about revenge, and the next one is about forgiveness, which, you know, is not as satisfying, I know. But Plea of the Penitent. Forgive us our sins, mostly the result of a deficit of attention. Options tower on pallets and we wander the aisles, dazed warehouse shoppers recklessly grabbing gallon tubs of Thousand Island when what we need are paper towels and bleach. We want to try to do better, to try again, to try not to, one more time, and this time really not. Not down another world's best dad mug of Maker's Mark, not smoke another last cigarette, not even a menthol ultralight, not even on the porch away from the baby, not cheat at cards or on our husbands, not play another hand, bet another next month's paycheck, or let another palm coast our thighs, drawing a straight flush from skin that thrills, even as foreboding floods the cellars of our heart. We're the best-selling authors of grave mistakes. Our advance is regret, 6 figures, but never enough for a down payment on restraint. We're sincere as hell, though, when we apologize, pleading into the disconnect tone, or mouthing the rosary after confession, even as we plot what we can write next on this blank slate. Give us this day our daily second chance. Let us atone like the Hindus who lift curses by marrying strays draped in yellow saris and garlands of jasmines and orchids. Take us to the pound in Leon County, to the gravel runs in the back. Show us the arthritic husky or the tumored retriever, the one shivering with anticipation for the long car ride home. This poem is one of a series that I have called the Palm Leaf Manuscript. Palm leaves were among some of the first materials for recorded documents. They're thousands of years old, and preservationists are now scrambling to try to transcribe and conserve these documents that are disintegrating, and these the information that I read about the palm leaf manuscripts just made me think about how we tell stories and try to pass things on. And so I have myths and fables and fairy tales in my palm leaf manuscript. And this one is a myth. Remember the woman who told you she found a dead cat on her deck, fur matted with August rain? How her husband nudged it onto cardboard with his loafer and dropped it over the fence into the neighbor's azaleas? Make her you, you 10, her husband your father before the divorce. Make the cat a mole, small, the size of the hollow rock with the spare key. A star-nosed mole, Congelura cristata, who breathes underground, blind, whose snout tentacles sniff out and consume the grout and worm faster than the eye can follow. Make August February, the shoe a shovel. Let the shovel crack the frozen fur. Say you turned your face and saw your father's shirts brittle on the clothesline, glazed with ice, and heard the shovel ring like the clapper of the church bell. This is the story the elders will tell when the wheat withers on the stalk and the firstborn swallow their tongues. The story they'll repeat when the cattle fall like trees and the trees fall like drunkards. This, the myth of the god of despair, who is the father of the god of attention. Never trust a poem that begins with a dream. Unless it's a love poem or the dream is the one you keep having, where you leave a raucous party, the kind of party you're never invited to, and sit on the balcony, just starting to tear up, but not yet crying. Most nights, the balcony is the second-story walkway of a motel, and the party is in full swing in the room behind you, the white stripes vibrating the stucco, and someone's cigarette, you imagine, burning holes in the bedspread. A man always follows you out, and as you're trying to remember who said, loneliness is the first thing which God's eye named, not good, he puts his arm around you and whispers something you never remember when you wake up, like the scene in an arty film where you don't get to hear the mumbled last words. Some nights, he's the boy you had a crush on in eighth grade, who did, in fact, put his arm across your shoulders in the cafeteria, sparks cascading down your back under the Peter Pan-collared Catholic schoolgirl blouse you wore unironically, being a Catholic schoolgirl. Other nights, he's the biology teacher who told oral sex jokes but let you take a C- instead of dissecting the frog and fetal pig, even let you leave the room during the dissecting to escape that sharp odor and soft snipping sounds. But in the dream, you aren't thinking how amazing it is you even graduated, given how much you refused to do and how often you skipped class to get stoned behind the library. And you're not realizing gratefully how many concessions pity won you. Instead, you're noticing how his breath on your ear lets you feel those delicate folds of skin you rarely think of, the way wind moving through grass lets you see the separate blades. But then you start to notice, too, the same adult touching a child in an overly intimate but not quite inappropriate way, ickiness, you felt when a family friend stroked your silky 7-year-old head and promised, I'll take you away with me. You'll be my child bride. And then you remember, in the dream, the joke the biology teacher told that ended sucking the chrome off a trailer hitch. Other nights, he's the dentist who tightened your braces, or the guy in college who sang you Purple Rain while he played a keyboard, whom you felt sorry for and kissed. Or the Pakistani dry cleaner who proposed, pledging robust suns and starched slacks. But on the best nights, when you've fallen asleep with the right mix of herbal tea and Law and Order reruns, he's your husband, the one you had or have or will have, your husband's arm the right weight and length to drape your shoulders as you brood, which God's eye named not good, which God's eye named not good. And his voice is warm in your hair, answering, it was Milton, ready to go home. So I would like to read three poems from the new collection I'm working on, which is tentatively titled Prayer Book of the Extremely Anxious. I have to thank Barbara Hamby for the title of my original book. That's all her, and she's really the title whisperer. The year that I started using the title she suggested, my book got published, so she should start a service titling books. If a sound had risen, would there have been ears to hear it? The canticles failed. Our tongues thickened with years of thirst, clappers stolen from the church bells, the organ coughing, hoarse-throated and tuneless. The psalms failed. On stiff knees, we stuttered our poor translations, grasping for the wrong words with our high school Latin. Never, instead of gratitude, a ceaseless downpour that should have been replenishing waters. The vespers failed, muted by dusk. Night collapsed upon us as our lips parted to chant the liturgy. Fill the starved, if not with the nourishment of bread, then the weight of stones. But the words scattered like startlings from the thicket. And the prayers never rose past the vapor of the troposphere. Some snagged on the lower branches of oaks, hanging like Spanish moss, a gauzy haze like the swelter of August rising from our few paved roads. Most sank into the river no mother lets her child swim in, settling in the muck of that brackish bed like weighted bodies, wrists bound, hands clasped before them. So my dog is dying, and I talk about that obsessively. On the first day of class this term, as I was preparing to meet my students, I was like, Josephine, don't talk about your dog. Do not talk about your dog. And then, of course, I did. And if anyone knows how many dying dog poems you can have in one poetry collection, please email me later. The second love. The first dog died to spite me. That's how love is. Better get used to it. I got another dog I named Grief. He runs wild in the garden, upsetting the tomatoes, knocking free the summer squash. I call him from the front stoop. Grief! Here, Grief! He always comes. Good boy. Good Grief. And I want to thank Keith for arranging this reading, and Aaron and the English department for inviting me, and for all of you for coming out tonight when you could be at home listening to what I'm sure is an extremely eloquent presidential speech. I assume that many people here feel the way I do, like we're at the beginning of a dystopian novel. And my last poem tonight kind of speaks to some of that anxiety. In times such as these, we find we must make do. I need an oracle, but I'll take a phone book, a therapist, any 1-800 hotline on a box of nasal spray. Someone, somewhere, must know something. I need a morphine drip, a stretcher, an exam table with Allen stirrups, a CAT scan or two. There are things they missed at my last checkup. This knot on my aorta, like a branch stump on the trunk of a tree, and this plummeting uncertainty, a host of symptoms. I'd settle for an Advil and a Fresca. I need an expert witness to testify, a peer-reviewed article, results confirmed in a clinical trial. I'll take the cabbie smoking at the 7-Eleven, minding his own business, didn't see anything. Or the 1944 Funkin Wagnall's New Standard Encyclopedia of Universal Knowledge, 25 cracked spine volumes molding in my parents' sunroom. I need a verdict passed down by a jury of my peers, a mea culpa, a speech launched beneath a net of balloons. I'll take a horoscope, a fortune cookie prophecy, the blue window of a magic eight ball, restoring order with a cool, it is decidedly so. I need a cathedral, old school, all gray stone and buttress, and a confessional like a dank mouth biting the tongue of my secrets. I need a meadow. I need some goddamn peace and quiet so I can finally think. Instead, my neighbor's Lilith Fair CD bleeding through our shared kitchen wall and a dog barking from a car driving past the house. I need a couch and a nap in the rain. Don't you think it's time to lie down for a bit? No, you're right, you're right. We'd be lucky to snag an empty chair in the boarding lounge or a scrub of carpet at the window overlooking the runway where we could watch our breath on the glass and the plane taxiing toward us, any plane, to take us to any destination, anywhere we know we'd land safely. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Up first to introduce our next reader is Mark Weingartner.
Hello. So it's my pleasure to introduce Russ Franklin, who's really one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. There's a scene that features Russ Franklin in a biography of a guy named Williamson S. Stuckey Sr. Now, if you know Williamson S. Stuckey Sr., and you do, you know his works, if you've driven anywhere in America, but certainly across the American South, because he was famous from in the 1930s, just as automobile traffic began to increase to and from Florida along the eastern seaboard. Williamson S. Stuckey Sr. had an especially bountiful pecan harvest one year and decided to sell some of it from a roadside lean-to along Georgia State Route 23. People traveling down that road quickly bought out all his pecans. Following that success, Stuckey's wife began selling her homemade pecan candies. By 1937, their business known as Stuckey's was booming, and they were ready to move beyond their lean-to into a new building. The Stuckey's Pecan Log Roll, as it's now known, is based on the family secret recipe of powdered sugar, white molasses, and roasted nuts. Now, Russ is not a major character in this biography, but he does, in fact, appear. There's a picture of him as a toddler at what I think is his birthday party. But it's not about him, but it is about his grandfather. Stuckey loved children, the biography reads, and children loved him. This included his own children, later his grandchildren, and his employees' and friends' children. There was an affinity between him and children, children being the theme of this paragraph. And he liked having them around. His important board meetings were always open to children who happened along. For example, his grandson, Russell Dean Franklin III, would sometimes sit in on very important meetings, being very quiet and still. This is really, I'm not sure how old Russ is. It doesn't say in that scene. That scene is not illustrated. But it's the perfect Russ Franklin anecdote, I think. There's that sort of quiet presence in that scene of the little kid who's just in the boardroom soaking up what's going on there, learning it for the sake of learning it. That sort of quiet curiosity pervades everything about Russ's life, I think, because Russ Franklin, and I would not use this term lightly, is a true polymath. Now, classically, a polymath was someone who had, quote, had learnt much, conquering many different subject areas. It was originally applied to the 15th century polymath Leon Battista Alberti, who was an architect, painter, horseman, archer, and inventor, who wrote, "A man can do all things if he will." During the Renaissance, polymathy became part of the idea of the perfected man, the manifold master of intellectual, artistic, and physical pursuits. Leonardo da Vinci was said to be prouder of his ability to bend iron bars with his hands than he was of the Mona Lisa. Now, one thing that's characteristic, we live in an age of specialization. At a university, it's particularly, it's a particular pathology often. People who are so specialized, they're not psychopaths, but monopaths. And you don't really meet so many polymaths. But one perhaps counterintuitive characteristic of the true polymath is humility, that interest in many different things, at a deep level, not just to read about, but to do, but not just to do, but to read about. That kind of engagement in a breadth of life's rich pageant comes almost always with a deep-seated kind of humility. Russ Franklin is a guy who has degrees in mathematics and physics and literature, and in 1999, a PhD in creative writing from Florida State University. He's taught at Florida State, sort of like, I mean, he comes in, he goes, he teaches his courses, he doesn't toot his own horn, and the English department employs about 100 people. Russ has been there longer than, by my count, everybody but 14 of them, including me. I am not among that 14, almost all of whom are on the cusp of retirement. And yet, a great many people in the department don't even know who Russ is. This is an enormous victory, if you've ever been in an English department, to work at a place, for 27 years without anybody knowing who the fuck you are, is one of the great, great, great achievements of Russ's life, and anyone's. I wish I had done the same. But it's not just that Russ teaches, you know, he's taught fiction and poetry and published quite a bit of each, but he became interested in graphic novels and thought he might want to teach it. And, you know, what a dilettantish English professor like me would do in that situation where he'd have meant such an idea was either try to write one and fail at it or just read a bunch of it and just try to fake it in class. Russ took classes and learned how to draw so that he could teach the class in the art department and be able to talk intelligently to art students taking a graphic novel class so that it could be a worthwhile class for a population both of English majors and art majors. But this is a guy who's he and I might be the only two people in the English department with an unironic appreciation of NASCAR. He's been involved in business, probably from before the time he was welcomed quietly and politely into those board meetings. He's been involved, you could know him for years and not know this aspect of Russ's life, or that he comes from the roadside legendary business Stuckey's. He's the former chair of the family Citizens Bank and Trust Company. He still serves on their board. He plays the stock market like a gambler, but he also, he will always, like a lot of people who probably gamble on the stock market and other things, you ask him about sports and he doesn't necessarily care about it, but then he's got money on it. And you don't really know where, it's like, well, I don't really gamble. But then he always knows what the spread is. I don't really want to know how that is going on. It's just sort of in the fabric of things without being explained too much. He knows a lot about astronomy. He knows a lot about forestry. He's the former chairman, in fact, of the nonprofit Stuckey Timberland, a family forestry company, and he was on the board of the Forest Landowners Association, a nonprofit forestry concern. He's an excellent fisherman, I guess, from my standard, because I'm terrible about it. He might say otherwise, but because he takes me out on his boat occasionally, I will stick by his excellence. I basically am just content to sit in the boat anyway. And he's a certified scuba diver. He's a private pilot, and probably dozens more interests and passions that I don't know about. And that he probably would only tell you about in passing, because Russ is also as humble and self-effacing as anybody I know. He was a Wallace Stegner Fellow, part of a run that it was, some of you in the audience here need to step this back up. We had about a 6-year run where we had a Stegner Fellow every year, and that run that streak was kicked off by Adam Johnson, and then the following year, Russ Franklin. He was a Stegner Fellow and a Truman Capote Fellow in fiction at Stanford. He was a Kingsbury Fellow here at FSU. His work has appeared in the Oxford American, the Alaska Quarterly Review, Greensboro Review, and other publications. His novel, Cosmic Hotel, incorporates a lot of these polymath interests. It's a novel about business, a novel about that concerns astronomy, flight, For those of you who've urinated in the bathroom in Russ's man cave, you'll recognize the interest in Elvis popping up both there and in Cosmic Hotel. Many other excellent things, including an alien, the ultimate unwanted house guest. Ladies and gentlemen, Russ Franklin.
That was great. Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Josephine, for sharing tonight with me. That's wonderful. And for being invited. And I get my card says rise up. Is that Matt? Is that have you been doing that for the That's pretty cool. I called him Big Daddy. We all called him Big Daddy, my grandfather. And I did spend a lot of time in board meetings growing up. And then when I finished my PhD, I had no idea that this was happening. I was going to go on and just teach and, you know, read. And my mama said, well, now you got to serve on the board and it's your time or whatnot. And I was like, shit, I don't like to do this. I thought that I would never have to do this again. And so it was kind of odd that when I got the news that I was headed to California on fellowship, I was like, oh, this is my chance. I'm gonna tell them that I'm going back to school, and they're going to tell me no, and I'm going to stand up on the board table and take down my pants and just tell them all to screw off and everything. And so I went to that board meeting and said, hey, I got some news. I'm going to Stanford for 2 years, and then everybody just took a little bit of silence, and then they started figuring out how I could fly to all these things. They were like, oh, okay, we can get you to the Forest Landowners Association in March, and I was like, shit, this is not working out like I wanted to, so I didn't get to do that. A lot of that was put in, went into this novel. A lot of that board time was put in this novel. I spent some time in hotels that I was supposed to be doing other stuff, attending conferences, breakout, writing the, watching porn and writing this novel. And so this, it's Sandeep Sanghavi is the 27-year-old narrator of this story. He works with his mother, and she owns a business. She's their hotel consultant. Her name is Elizabeth Sanghavi. He's of mixed race. His mother is Indian, and his father is Sopchapian, white Sopchapian. And the mother is very pragmatic businesswoman. And the father is a famous astronomer. He's never gone back to Sopchapi. He spent all his time. He's an arrogant asshole. He teaches currently when the novel opens at Stanford. He's self-centered, pompous, a basic character totally on every creative writing teacher I've known. And he has got in trouble recently. He showed up at a faculty meeting with a glass of Guinness beer that he put ice cubes in it, and somebody asked him about it, and he says it's iced coffee. And so they have a confrontation with him and say, look, you got to go to AA. And it sounded like such a commitment, he quit drinking. AA sounded like such a commitment, he quit drinking. And so he hasn't had a drink in 2 years, and when the novel starts, he's kind of started experimenting back with that. And so I'm going to read just two short sections of this, and the first section is about the father. His name is Charles Van Ray, but the public knows him as Van Ray. All his popular science books just have Van Ray on it. And he has just called Sandeep out of a meeting at a hotel in Dallas-Fort Worth to tell him that he has heard on the Stanford Big Dish antenna. Nobody knows this yet, but he's heard the noise from an exoplanet that means there's a civilization there. And Sandeep's trying to figure out if he wants to believe his father, because his father backs this up with saying, hey, can I have some money too? Will you send me some money? And so he's trying to figure that out. Sandeep and his mother have never lived in a home. They've only lived in hotels, and Sandeep is comfortable with this. He likes the staff. He likes room service. He likes all of this. But lately, and there was a big boom in hotel business in the 60s and 70s where there were a lot of buildings that were constructed, and so they cycled out during 2010, and so where it was just cheaper to tear these hotel buildings down. They had no value architecturally, and it was cheaper to tear them down and build them back up. He and his mom, their job has turned into telling people at hotels, you're fired because we're tearing the hotel down. And this is really weighing on him. His mom is Elizabeth Sanghavi, and he is Sandeep Sanghavi. I'm going to read this first section about Van Ray. He's gotten the phone call, and he's like, okay, if what he says is true, how big an asshole is he going to be? He's trying to judge. He's like, is my father, who's had ups and downs, has he been a good person during the ups when he's popular, or has he been an asshole? His mom and dad were divorced when he was very young. Van Ray had written the popular science books Perfect Randomness, Renaming the Sky, My Year of Quantum Weirdness, and The Report from Earth. They were popular enough that I occasionally saw a person reading one in the airport, found a tattered copy of The Report from Earth in a beach condo one year. He used to occasionally pop up on congressional hearings wearing all black, his white hair styled into disarray to look the part of the mad scientist. His most recent article had been a 25,000-word treatise in World Magazine about strip clubs. He was an interesting character, and people wanted to know what he thought of everything, but he was a gangly man who loved women, had dated a few famous women, been married 5 times, and he had a difficult reputation among his academic peers, made worse when he dressed shabbily and showed up at parties with attractive younger women. He lived in a big house on the campus of an important university, had made a fortune 3 times and gone broke 4, lost half of Elizabeth's net worth before I was age 5. He was a storyteller, a brilliant mathematician, but he still drove a late model sports car to the liquor store to buy Powerball lotto tickets, hoping to defy the odds, and he had been married 5 times, declaring himself in an essay a habitual monogamist. I began thinking about his early successful books and who he was during this period when he was a guest on talk shows. He was an ass. I remember the red Alfa Romeo he had the year California Public Television had produced a 6-episode TV series hosted by Van Ray. I had just turned 14, and after not seeing him or hearing from him in over a year, I forced him to let me come visit California. He met me at the airport, him wearing green sunglasses like a movie star. I came down the long airport hallway into the real world and saw the green lenses were attached to the front of his prescription glasses, and that unruly white hair was a garland around the dome of his head. For someone raised in Florida, he had pale skin that blushed easily, always seemed a shade of splotchy red, especially the bumpy suborbital ridge down the center of his bald head that looked like the relief map of the Himalayas. He put his hand on my shoulder. He squinched his nose up and said, "Jesus, look at you," pulling me along, forcing a smile as he studied me, as if I were not the person he'd expected to get off the plane. I thought something was wrong with me, and the first chance I got, I excused myself to the airport bathroom to ostensibly wash my face, but really to check myself in the mirror to make sure nothing had happened to me on the flight. Why had he given me that look? In the mirror, I appeared normal, dare I say, not a bad-looking guy. look at the pictures of Van Ray. Bushy eyebrows, the ugly head, thin lips, stooped posture that so many tall people get. I could not think of his physical appearance without thinking of the word bones. After checking my face in the bathroom mirror that day, I dried it and went out and continued with his escort, him telling me of his plans, stealing glances at me. It had been over a year since he'd seen me. Elizabeth had been against this trip. Elizabeth is his mom. He addresses her always as Elizabeth. "Why do you want to spend time with him?" she had asked. I think Elizabeth believed she had conceived me by herself like a plant. In the parking garage that day, Charles and I stood over a bright red convertible, top down, a sports car, a man's car, a cliche that had been illegally parked on the yellow stripes, and he threw a set of keys to me. "You drive," he said. I told him I was only 14, and he seemed surprised, but that didn't stop his plan. Van Ray and I spent an hour sputtering and stalling the Alfa Romeo on the top parking deck, him showing me how to give it some gas and let the clutch out. And after a couple of laps, he asked me if I was ready and pointed to the exit ramp. I never told him, but I wasn't exactly ready. I stalled in front of the woman taking our money for parking. The woman in the booth looked at him as I re-cranked, and she said, "Aren't you an actor?" "No," he said, "an astronomer." She said, "Oh," and asked us if we needed a receipt. The price was $10 to let us out into the world together. The gate went up, and I made the Alpha go forward, him nudging the steering wheel when we needed to take a certain exit. He pulled a driving hat out from between the seats and wore it backward. I was 2 years away from any legal driver's license and very uneven with the accelerator. Van Ray glanced behind us as we merged into the interstate, and he judged things just right. "You're doing fine. Aren't you having fun? Isn't this fun?" 14 and gripping the wheel for the first time in my life. It was all I could do to concentrate and drive through the desert. Back then, he worked at a university that had an 11-mile loop of underground particle accelerator with a highway built over it that Van Ray used as his own personal racetrack. When I hazarded a look, he was rather obnoxiously posed with those green glasses, that hat, his cheeks sucked in so he could hold them between his molars to make dimples. Lining the highway were sterile office buildings crowned with thorny antenna arrays, and the brighter stars and planets came out in the purple sky. Under the ground below us, protons were smashing into protons like fireworks, and the ends of his hair danced about his hat as if electrified. So that is Charles. And Sandeep's trying to figure out whether he's going to trust this man for the first time. And Sandeep, he's... searches these popular science books where Van Ray talks about dancing, strippers, cars, strippers, science a little bit, for anything that mentions Sandeep, and he never can find it in his father's book. So Sandeep has got all this pressure on him. He's trying to figure out if his father's lying or not. He's closing down these hotels. And so in chapter 14... Infamous. I actually had to add this chapter back in there. He's trying to seek. He's been on his anxiety and depression medication for over half his life, which his mother wants him to get off, because his mother keeps telling him America is full of over-medicated crybabies. She's quite the racist. Love her, Elizabeth. He's never been to India, and she goes, "No, you can't go to India. I've seen Americans get sunburn through their hat and die. You can't go back there." So he goes to a doctor seeking more medication for this. And his mother is full of all these sayings and observation. And one of the observations that she's made and told him is that you can tell the economic circumstance someone's been raised in by how far apart they hold their feet, their shoes, because Elizabeth's belief is if you hold them close together, you can scuff your shoes, so you have no idea of money or the value of things. But people that have made their own money and have keep their feet apart, she's crazy. And I love her. He's also recently created a playlist on his phone called Songs to Beat Depression, which I highly suggest to anybody. Just take the songs that make you feel good no matter what and put on your Songs to Beat Depression so you can just play that when you're feeling made a little bit more pep than the pills. But his problem is he's only got one song on there, which is Viva Las Vegas, because his mom, he and his mom recently watched Viva Las Vegas, because his mom loves the celebrity biographies, American celebrity biographies. The more sordid the downfall, the better. And so Elvis holds a special place for her, proving once again that America's full of over-medicated crybabies. The chapter before 14 ends. That Wednesday, I went to see a doctor in a strip mall. And so this is the strip mall doctor. He's 27 here. I'm freaked out. By the luck of the draw, I got an Indian doctor. He thumped my chest and instructed me to take deep breaths, which took me to the point of dizziness. Dr. Ahuja was in his 50s, hair parted in the middle, stringy bangs, and eyes so small they appeared closed and suspicious of everything. He probably had an Indian mother somewhere out there who was either very proud of him for being a doctor or who thought being only an internist in a strip mall was a big failure. When I told him my eye was twitching, he squinted even harder but said, "No, they're not twitching." Redressed and sitting in his office, I stared at the changing pictures in his digital photo frame on his desk. The frame had the swirling logo of the drug company's name on it. A picture brightened in the screen, a pair of bare feet propped on a table framing the Eiffel Tower. Then the picture changed to bare feet framing Big Ben. I was pretty sure these were Dr. Ahuja's feet. "I think I might be getting depressed again," I said. There were superficial scuff on the side of my loafer. "I can't seem to relax. I don't think the Rosalyn is working. Could I be building up a tolerance?" "No," he said, looking at my records on his computer from dozens of other doctors in my past. I almost expected him to tell me that America was full of over-medicated crybabies, but I'd listened and heard no accent. I'm guessing, like me, he had been born here. The digital frame on his desk changed to a picture of his bare feet framing the pyramids. And I tried to control myself from rubbing the mark off my shoe. Scuff shoes, no appreciation for the value of things. "Can you describe in greater detail how you're feeling?" he asked. I crossed my leg to bring the shoe closer. "I have this twitching in my eye, like I said. Stop. It says here you're refusing an influenza shot. I want you to tell me why." "I never get the flu," I said. He made a distrustful sound in his throat and a small laugh, and I used the moment to lick my thumb and wipe the scratch off my shoe. The picture frame on his desk changed to his legs propped on a backpack, his bare feet framing snow-capped mountains. He asked, "You were how old during this first period here when you were last paralyzed?" "Last time? 14, I said. "But I had milder cases when I was 6 and 8. "Ventilator?" he asked. He'd just examined me and seen no scar on my throat, and this mistake made me picture a disappointed Indian mother frowning at him. "No," I said. That last episode of paralysis happened after I'd visited Van Ray with the Alfa Romeo in the desert. I'd flown back to Elizabeth, who was living in a hotel in Baltimore. Tingling began in my extremities. In a matter of hours, I'd been unable to talk. Dr. Ahuja asked me, "Did anyone ever give a firm diagnosis?" "No, it just went away." I remembered how doctors had examined the 14-year-old me trying diagnosis on me like shoes. "He has Guillain-Barré syndrome, ruling each one out, West Nile virus, MS, mercury poisoning." There seemed some comfort in Elizabeth telling them that it had happened before when I was 6, once when I was 8, and simply gone away both times. Dr. Ahuja's brow wrinkled, and for the first time I could see his brown eyes, but he squinted again at the picture changed to his bare feet framing an alpine chateau. I was stressed then too, like I am now. That's what I'm worried about, I said. I haven't been sick at all since. I mean, not even the sniffles. I don't need a flu shot. I just don't want to get emotionally unbalanced, or I'm worried about the paralysis happening again. The flu shot is unnecessary. My mother says I have the Indian immune system. He said, that's absurd. My biological father is from rural Florida. I've got a weird combination of third world immune systems. He said, may I see your medical degree? Idiotically, I touched the pocket of my jacket, but he said, no, you don't have one. I do. What you are saying has no scientific facts. He looked down at his computer and began rapidly typing. What happened to you has a medical reason. It just hasn't been found yet. Stay away from superstitions. I would suggest that you let good medical professionals collect the facts and let them give you answers. Calcutta and Miami immune systems have nothing to do with each other. I didn't say Miami, I said Florida. There's a difference. I know the difference, he said. And I would also strongly suggest you take a flu shot. He asked me, and you think you're depressed? Describe how you feel. He squinted into the fluorescent lighting, prepared to analyze my answer. How could I explain? I thought about my playlist, Songs to Beat Depression. You know how when you're listening to music, I said, okay, on the shuffle function, it gives you random songs supposedly designed for you by your previous choices, right? Of course, I know this. And some days, every song the computer sends me makes me feel great, like the best song I've ever felt. On other days, it shuffles songs. I shrug my shoulders. You know, every song makes you feel terrible. They're all bummers. Then I realize it's not the music, it's me. I only listen to one song, basically. Only one song makes me feel good. You listen to the same song over and over? Kind of, I said. I just have the feeling everyone is happier than I am. I just want to feel like everyone else. That's exactly what everyone else says, Dr. Ahuja said. He tapped a keyboard to go back over something. He nodded his head. Okay. Okay. He tilted his chin at me. Do you have any thoughts of suicide? Suicide? I thought. Before I could answer, he held up his hand to stop me. What was that in your mind? He admonished me with his hand. Stop. Free association only. The thing that popped in your mind. Close your eyes. I did. I backed my mind up and saw a cart full of cleaning supplies, and I saw housekeeping women pushing the cart. I realized that it had always been the morning staff that found suicides in hotels. I said to Dr. Ahuja, morning maids, hotel morning maids. His chair squeaked. Interesting, he said. What are they mourning? No, morning maids, I said, like housekeeping, like in hotels in the morning, cleaning. I don't think that will make sense to you. It makes sense to me, he said. But morning maids is what I thought about. My mother and I live in an environment where everyone resents us. Everyone resents you. Interesting. Okay, the question again, and I'll let you answer it. Any thought of suicide? No, I said. Let me ask you this. He touched his fingertips together between his nose. Are you getting ready to go on a trip? What? A trip. Travel, he repeated. Always. See, I knew. I can tell. He smiled, pleased with himself. Travel is very stressful. He swiveled in his chair and picked up a brown box from the floor, set it on his desk, took sample boxes out, and he slid them across the desk to me. This is going to help you, he said. He explained this was a new, common help people took and explained the dosages and told me to taper off the Rosalind. This is newer, more effective, fewer side effects. This is my preference, he said. He waited. It was called Elipam. When I didn't say anything right away, he pushed three more sample boxes to me. I finally said, Sometimes I have trouble sleeping too. My choice for my patients is somatropin. I turned the box of Elipam over. On the back were words and complicated chemical contents and warnings. Shaking the box, it rattled with tinfoil pill sleeves. And on the front of the box was a formless figure dancing, sexless and twirling with arms overhead. And I realized that the swirling at the feet was a drug company logo on the frame of his digital photo frame. Dr. Hooja was working at the computer, the mouse clicking faster. It took him about 10 seconds to send the prescription to every pharmacy in the world. "That's it. Godspeed," he said. "Enjoy your travels." I checked out with the woman who had been the nurse who weighed me and took my initial blood pressure, now sliding the translucent glass open and taking my credit card. All the magazines in the waiting room were business magazines, and she handed me the receipt for my visit, rather expensive for what he'd done. It reminded me of the warning Van Ray had written in an essay in My Year of Quantum Weirdness. Every doctor thinks he can be a businessman, and every businessman thinks he can be a lawyer, and every lawyer thinks he can be a writer, and every writer thinks he's right about everything. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks, y'all. Thanks. My pleasure.